politics, science, to hide behind her skirts? Ayers remark that children are profoundly affected by the hope they see in the adult world may be the key to the dismay and disorder of children. What hope do they see in the adult world?
Pinning hope on a child and its future is easier than finding a larger hope for the adult world itself.
Archaic peoples and tribal communities offered their children constancy, an unlimited time span of continuities. Cyclical changes and nomadic migrations did not shake the foundations. Myths made life livable, and hope was not even a category of archaic existence. Hope enters history and our psychology as trust in continuity fades. Our main myth is apocalyptic, as the Revelation of St. John, the last book of our Bible, says. And our children today live among and act out images of catastrophe. Of course, suicide among children shows a startling rise. How troubling it must be for a child to tie its star to a collapsing structure of depletion, extinction, and loss that cannot be repaired by bonding people together in satisfying human relationships. It's all beyond people, says this myth. The only hope, according to the authorized version of the catastrophe, is in a divine redemption and a second chance. In face of that cosmic science fiction of Armageddon, psychology's scientific fiction narrows the cause of devastated children to dysfunctional parenting, while a world with all the parents in it edges toward the cliff. Absent the father.
Dad, are you home? Is anybody here?
No. Dad is out to lunch, and he should be, as I shall claim. His job is elsewhere, as I shall explain, because his fundamental value to the family is maintaining the connection to elsewhere. When we watch Dad on TV sitcoms and the accompanying ads, he's a rather foolish man. He's not quite with it. A piece of him is astray. Commentators on contemporary fatherhood complain that he is being deliberately made to look foolish and antiquated, because this weakened image helps take down the stuffed shirt power of the patriarchy, makes more equal the relations between the genders, and blurs the hierarchical differences between fathers and children. Therefore, wives are shown to be more practical and connected, children to be more with it and savvy. Even if he's a good guy, Dad is a little dumb. I want to suggest that something more is going on than shifting social conventions and softening of the patriarchal father. The comedy played out on TV has a subtle subplot with appropriate foundations. Maybe Dad's true task is not knowing about coffee, bleach, and mouthwash, or how to resolve pubescent dating dilemmas. And maybe his dumbness shows that this is truly not his world. His world is not shown in these sets, for it's offstage, elsewhere, and invisible. He must keep one foot in another space, one ear cocked for other messages. He must not lose his calling or forget obligations to the heart's desire and the image that he embodies. Of course, this is not an obligation only of men, but it is men who are defined as absent. So our psychological task is to explore this absence beyond the usual charges of desertion, workaholic addiction, negligent unrelatedness, lack of child support payments, double standardism, and patriarchal pomp, which are rightly laid at the feet of many fathers. Fathers have been far away for centuries, on military campaigns, as sailors on distant seas for years at a time, as cattle drivers, travelers, trappers, prospectors, messengers, prisoners, jobbers, peddlers, slavers, pirates, missionaries, migrant workers. The work week was once 72 hours. The construct fatherhood shows widely different faces in different countries, classes, occupations, and historical times. Only today is absence so shaming and declared a criminal, even criminal-producing behavior. As a social evil, the absent father is one of the bogeys of the remedial age, this historical period of therapy, recovery, and social programs that try to fix what we do not understand. The conventional father image of a man at his job, coming home at dusk to his family, earning, sharing, and caring, with quality time for his kids, is another fantasy of the parental fallacy. This image is way off its statistical base, As of 1993, only a very few families in the United States fit the pattern of a working husband-father earning for a family consisting of a stay-at-home wife-mother and their own two children. Everyone else is doing something different. The statistical pull in a father is thus preponderantly not to fulfill this image, just as for a woman it is not to fulfill the image of a stay-at-home wife-mother. If family values mean parents' togetherness with their natural children in their own house, these values have little to do with how the American people actually live. Rather than blaming fathers for their absenteeism and the concomitant unfairness of loading extra burdens onto mothers, mentors, the schools, the police, and taxpayers, we need to ask where Dad might be when he's not at home. When he is absent, to what else might he be present? What calls him away? Rilke has an answer. Sometimes a man stands up during supper and walks outdoors and keeps on walking because of a church that stands somewhere in the east, and his children say blessings on him as if he were dead. And another man who remains inside his own house dies there, inside the dishes and in the glasses, so that his children have to go far out into the world toward that same church which he forgot. Rilke accounts for the father's absence. What about the quality of his presence? That anger, that hatred? Why is father such an abusive, brutal family destroyer? What is this rage? Is it really his wife he hates, his children he wants to beat, because no one does what he says and they cost so much? Or might there be another factor, less personal and more demonic, that has him and doesn't let up? I have come to be convinced that the parental fallacy itself has harnessed father's spirit to a false image, and his daimon turns demonic in kicking against the traces. He is trapped in a construct called American fatherhood, a moral commandment to be the kind of good guy who likes Disneyland and kids' food, gadgets, opinions, and wisecracks. This bland model betrays his necessary angel, that image of whatever else he carries in his heart, glimpsed from childhood into the present day, and which this book would confirm for him. The man who has lost his angel becomes demonic, and the absence, the anger, and the paralysis on the couch are all symptoms of the soul in search of a lost call to something other and beyond. Father's oscillations between rage and apathy, like his children's allergies and behavior disorders, and his wife's depressions and bitter resentments, form part of a pattern they all share. Not the family system, but the system of rip-off economics that promotes their communal senselessness by substituting more for beyond. And so his absences, physical, mental, spiritual, call him away from the cage of American delusions that crush the angel's wings. Without inspiration, what's left is bare, aimless ferocity. Without desire for an ideal, what's left is lustful fantasy, and the seduction of free-floating images that find no anchor in actual projects. Present in body and absent in spirit, he lies back on the couch, shamed by his own daimon for the potentials in his soul that will not be subdued. He feels himself inwardly subversive, imagining in his passivity extremes of aggression and desire that must be suppressed. Solution? More work, more money, more drink, more weight, more things, more infotainment, and an almost fanatic dedication of his mature male life to the kids so that they can grow up straight and straight up the consumer ladder in the pursuit of their happiness. A happy child was never and nowhere the aim of parenting. An industrious, useful child, a malleable child, a healthy child, an obedient, mannerly child, a stay-out-of-trouble child, a God-fearing child, an entertaining child, all these varieties, yes, but the parental fallacy has trapped the parents also in providing happiness, along with shoes, schoolbooks, and van-packed vacations. Can the unhappy produce happiness? Since happiness at its ancient source means eudaimonia, or a well-pleased daimon, only a daimon who is receiving its due can transmit a happy benefit to a child's soul. Yes, I am saying that care of soul, as Thomas More has written, may thereby help the child soul prosper. Should the onus of soul-making in the parent shift to making the soul of the child, then the parent is dodging the lifelong task set by the acorn. Then the child replaces the acorn. You feel your child is special, and you care for it as your calling, seeking to realize the acorn in your child. Sawyer Daimon complains because it is avoided, and your child complains because it has become an effigy of the parent's own calling. Your mother, as I said, may be a demon, but she is not your daimon. So your child, too, is not your daimon. I have learned through years of work with patients and in men's retreats and from listening to what cautions me that when a child substitutes for your daimon, you will resent that child, even grow to hate it, despite goodwill and high ethics. The novelist and brilliant social critic Michael Ventura writes that Americans hate their children. His observation seems preposterous.
What culture in history ever spoke more as a child, felt more as a child, thought more as a child,
or was more reluctant to put all childish things away? And what culture today campaigns more to save the children globally, provides more emergency help for preemies and for surgical transplants in infants, whatever the cost, and engages in more frontline defense of the fetus? Yet all this is a cover under which hides an appalling neglect. Just look at the evidence. Of the 57 million children under 15 years of age living in the United States, more than 14 million are living below the official poverty level. The United States ranks below Iran and Romania in the percentage of low birth weight babies. One of every six children is a stepchild, and 500,000 make their homes in residential treatment centers and group and foster homes. More children and adolescents in the United States die from suicide than from cancer, AIDS, birth defects, influenza, heart disease, and pneumonia combined. Each day, at least 1 million latchkey children go home to where there is a gun. Besides these children who find their way into sociological statistics, there are those from all economic classes in treatment for attention deficit disorders, hyperactivity, obesity, defiance, bulimia, depression, pregnancy, addiction. Gross economic injustice, political passivity, and the delusions of circuses without bread are responsible for the plight of children. But also I accuse the parental fallacy of sponsoring this negligence, parents' deficient attention to the individual call they brought with them into the world, and the hyperactivity of their distraction from this call betrays their reason for being alive. When your child becomes the reason for your life, you have abandoned the invisible reason you are here. And the reason you are here as an adult, as a citizen, as a parent, to make a world receptive to the daimon, to set the civilization straight so that a child can grow down into it, and its daimon can have a life. This is the parenting task. To carry out this task for the daimon of your child, you must bear witness first to your own. Any father who has abandoned the small voice of his unique genius, turning it over to the small child he has fathered, cannot bear reminders of what he has neglected. He cannot tolerate the idealism that arises so naturally and spontaneously in the child, the romantic enthusiasms, the sense of fairness, the clear-eyed beauty, the attachment to little things, and the interest in big questions. All this becomes unbearable to a man who has forgotten his daimon. Instead of learning from the child, who is living evidence of the invisibles in everyone's life, the father capitulates to the child, disturbing its growing down into civilization by setting it up in a toy world. Result, a child-dominated, fatherless culture with dysfunctional children with pistol-packing power. Like the vampires that so fascinate them, children in our culture, sentimentalized for their innocence and neglected on account of the bother they cause, drain away the blood of adult life. Ancestors. The belief that parents shape my world from the beginning strikes me as a variety of misplaced concreteness. I take the term from the English philosopher Alfred North Whitehead. Misplaced concreteness does not keep abstract and concrete distinct enough. Cosmic mythical parents and personal mothers and fathers get mixed up. Then the formative powers and mysteries assigned to abstractions such as heaven and earth sky god and earth goddess, or vice versa in Egyptian myth, become concrete mothers and fathers, while mothers and fathers are divinized, causing effects of cosmic proportion. The displaced powers of the mythical couple who sustain the world, like Zeus and Hera, become the family romance, as Freud called the fallacy. Involvements with parents make us or break us. Moreover, you believe you belong only to this personal story and your parents' personal influence on it, rather than to the invisible myths parents have displaced. Being shaped so fatally by the parental world means having lost the larger world parents, and also the world at large as parent. For the world, too, shapes us, nurtures us, teaches us. If today our civilization is turning toward the environment to stave off ecological disaster, the first step of this rapprochement with nature is to cross the threshold of the parental house into the home of the world. We are parented by everything around us. If parenting means watching, instructing, encouraging, and admonishing, do you really believe that humans invented the wheel out of their big brains alone, or fire, or baskets, or tools? Stones rolled downhill, bolts of fire shot from the sky and out of the earth. Birds wove and probed and pounded, as did apes and elephants. The sciences that master nature were taught by nature how it could be mastered. The more we cling to the overriding importance of parents, and the more cosmological power we accord them, the less we notice the fathering and mothering afforded by the world every day in what it sends our way. As J.J. Gibson's psychological school at Cornell University maintained, the world affords nesting and sheltering, nourishing and quenching, adventuring and playing. The world is made less of nouns than of verbs. It doesn't consist merely in objects and things. It is filled with useful, playful, and intriguing opportunities. The oriole doesn't see a branch, but an occasion for perching. The cat doesn't see a thing we call an empty box. It sees safe hiding for peering. The bear doesn't smell honeycomb, but the opportunity for delicious feeding. The world is buzzing and blooming with information, which is always available and never absent. Children especially recognize this nurturance and instruction offered by nature. According to the observations of the brilliant pioneer of ecology, Edith Cobb, the imagination of children depends wholly on this contact with the environment. Imagination does not grow all by itself in the household, or even out of imaginative tales told by parents. Children are, by nature, at home in the world. The world invites them to grow down and take part. And this is not merely a statement prompted by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Friedrich Froebel, the originator of the kindergarten, and Alice Miller. For I am not saying children are naturally good or whole, only that their imaginations and minds feed on a nature that is also their parent. Therefore, if our children today are disordered, it isn't so much parenting they need as, perhaps, less parentalism, which keeps them from trust and pleasure in the actual physical world. The more I believe my nature comes from my parents, the less open I am to the ruling influences around me, the less the surrounding world is felt to be intimately important to my story. Yet even biographies begin by locating the subject in a place. The self starts off amid the smells of a geography. The moment the angel enters a life, it enters an environment. We are ecological from day one. So the coming ecological disaster we worry about has already occurred and goes on occurring. It takes place in the accounts of ourselves that separate us from the world by attaching us to parentalism, the belief that what's out there is less of a factor than my close family in the formation of who I am. The parental fallacy is deadly to individual self-awareness, and it is killing the world. Until this psychological fallacy is set straight, no compassionate campaigns of multiculturalism and environmentalism, no field trips, Peace Corps, birdwatching, or whale songs can fundamentally reattach me to the world. First, I must make that psychological reconstruction, that leap of faith out of the house of the parents and into the home of the world. Psychotherapy compounds this fault. Its theory of developmental damage owing to the family actually turns the patient away from everything else that might give comfort and instruction. To what does the soul turn that has no therapists to visit? It takes its trouble to the trees, to the riverbank, to an animal companion, on an aimless walk through the city streets, a long watch of the night sky. Just stare out the window or boil water for a cup of tea. We breathe, expand, and let go. And something comes in from elsewhere. The daimon in the heart seems quietly pleased, preferring melancholy to desperation. It's in touch.
The facilitating environment so necessary to the fantasy of adequate parenting, according to D.W. Winnicott,
the gentle, down-home clinical philosopher of sensible therapy, is the actual environment, were it not so neglected and therefore feared. By leaving the actual world out of its main theoretical constructs, psychological theory imagines that world out there as objective, cold, indifferent, even hostile. Therapy as protective refuge, consulting room as sanctuary. Thus the world receives the projection of the bad mother, the killing mother, which its theory has invented. We're back to a world of nature as conceived by Descartes 4 centuries ago. Aber res extensa, an extended field of matter void of soul, inhospitable, mechanical, even demonic. Of course, there are demons out there to be propitiated. Disasters lurk, but these powers behind the door and in the bush are also ancestors, not merely germs, spiders, and quicksand. As we have misplaced the cosmological parents, so we have lost the ancestors too. The parents have swallowed them up. Our biographies and case histories begin with the facts of our parents and the place of our birth. They sometimes go back through the parents to the bloodline of 4 grandparents, in the best cases even to the 8 great-grandparents. Most stop their genealogy at mom and pop, some even at mom alone, since pop is always absent. Thus the idea of ancestors filters through actual parents. Besides their divinization as the movers and shakers of your heaven and earth, parents have also usurped the protective duties and the demands for attention traditionally accorded to the invisible ancestors. Ancestry in our culture implies chromosomal connection. Ancestors are those humans from whom I have inherited my body tissues. Biogenetics replaces the spirit world. In other societies, an ancestor could be a tree, a bear, a salmon, a member of the dead, a spirit in a dream, a special spooky place. These may be addressed as ancestor, and an altar home built for them, away from the home you inhabit. Ancestors are not bound to human bodies, and certainly not confined to physical antecedents whose descent into your sphere allowed only via your natural family. Only if a member of the natural family, itself not always determinable, say a grandparent or an uncle or an aunt, is worthy enough, powerful enough, knowledgeable enough, may he or she become an ancestor in the sense of a guardian spirit. To be an ancestor, you do not need to be dead, but you do need to know the dead, that is, the invisible world and how and where it touches the living. As spirits, ancestors are concerned with other spirits, the community as a whole, the things they live with, the locations in their environments, and the particular image in the heart that keeps your person hale and sees you through. When you boil over rashly, or grow lax and impotent, or become quarrelsome and petty, specific ancestors may be called on to ward off bad influences and set things right. None of these dysfunctional states is attributed to your parents. Whatever is wrong with you comes from elsewhere. Spells, taboo breaking, rituals unperformed, bad airs, waters, places, a distant enemy, an angry divinity, a neglected duty or forgotten offense. But never, never could the state of your soul be attributed to what your mother or father did to you some 30 years ago. They simply were the necessary occasion for your appearance in the community, their having performed the necessary rites that allowed your soul to enter the world. Without a sense of ancestors, what can we propitiate as having a direct and controlling influence over our lives but our parents? We take literally the commandment to honor thy father and thy mother, which shows decency and kindness.
But let's not forget that the 5th commandment, along with the ones preceding it,
aims to eliminate all traces of pagan polytheism, to which ancestor worship is essential. The text makes it clear that these parents are not just human mom and dad. They have huge powers and are to be honored as guarantors of fate, that thy days may be prolonged, and that it may go well with thee upon the land which the Lord thy God hath given thee. Deuteronomy 5:16. Like ancestor spirits, they are protective guardians of a long life, bearers of good fortune, and nature spirits inhabiting the land itself. By command, henceforth and forevermore, the parental fallacy is established. The primordial spirit world has been reduced to the all-too-human concrete statues of personal figures. This reduction by official religion of that splendid archaic menagerie of ancestors has taken centuries. We call it civilization. Gaia and Uranus, Geb and Nut, Bohr and Besla shrunk to this small measure of mom and pop. Not in heaven at all, just one easy flight up above our daily commerce. Our horizons have been cut down to their scale, and their scale magnified by what they replace, and our rituals, whither to once a year hallmark days in honor of them, care for their health and welfare, and phone calls, even if we continue to attribute immense determining power to their magical influence over our intimate lives. Honor thy father and thy mother. Yes, indeed. But do not confuse them with creator-destroyer gods or with ancestors. It is laborious to work through the parent problem because it is not a mere logical error or misplaced concreteness or a difficult step in a therapeutic process toward individual self-determination.
Working through the parental fallacy is more like a religious conversion.
Out of our secularism, out of our personalism, out of our monotheism, developmentalism, and belief in causality. It requires a step backward into the old connection with invisibilities and a trusting step out and over the threshold into the rich profusion of influences afforded by the world. Religion, Whitehead also said, is world loyalty. This could imply disloyalty to a belief long held dear by society as a whole, by therapy in general, and by you in particular. The belief in the power of parents.
Chapter 4. Back to the Invisibles. Since the acorn can't even be seen under a microscope, we postulate its invisible reality. To learn more about it, we need first to study the nature of invisibility. Invisibility perplexes American common sense and American psychology, which hold as a major governing principle that whatever exists, exists in some quantity, and therefore can be measured. If an image in the heart that calls you to your fate exists, and may be strong and long-lasting, has it measurable dimensions? A passion to cage the invisible by visible methods continues to motivate the science of psychology, even though that science has given up the century-long search for the soul in various body parts and systems. When the searchers failed to find the soul in the places where they were looking, scientistic psychology gave up also on the idea of soul. There are other approaches to the soul, other accounts of fate determining invisibilities. Swedes tell a folktale of the forests. The lumberjacks of northern pine, fir, and spruce used to work pretty much alone, felling trees, lopping branches. They drank, too, in the short days of white cold. Coffee, snaps. Sometimes Huldra would appear. She was an exquisitely formed creature, delicate, enchanting, and irresistible. Sometimes a woodcutter would stop his work, even drop his axe to follow her, beckoning farther into the woods. As he approached, she turned her back and vanished. Once Huldra turned her smiling face away, there was nothing. She had no back, or her back was invisible. And he, drawn too deeply into the forest, unable to find familiar markings or get back to a clearing, lost his bearings and froze. Mythical thinking. I am opening this chapter with a mythical tale of the siren, the wood nymph, the tree soul, and of the simple human at his chores who, at her disappearance, loses direction and motion and dies. The interpretation of the tale in terms of male and female roles, of archetypal anima, of losing the soul to fantasy projections, of the enchanted forest as mother domain, of archaic vegetative spirits taking revenge on man, the destructive axe murderer, these do not take the tale back far enough, back to the absent back of Huldra. Behind each and every interpretation of the tale is the tale. The tale provides the invisible backdrop against which all analyses parade their brilliance. Myth lies behind every account we give of it, and it gives no account of itself. Myths fall back on invisibility. They show an enchanting face, but their backing disappears under scrutiny. Nothing's there. We are lost in the woods. We can all tell tales of how myths came into being. Out of dreams, out of primitive man's attempt to explain the cosmos and its natural phenomena, as ways of establishing tribal law by reference to fearful powers, from shamanistic visions and revelations, or just in portentous elaborations of simple stories told by old women, after beer in the firelight, to pass the time or lull the young to sleep. Whatever the account of the origin of myth, what's behind myths remains inscrutable. Great philosophical questions turn on the relations of visible and invisible. Our religious beliefs separate heaven and earth, this life and the afterlife, and our philosophical thinking cuts apart mind and matter, all of which forces a chasm between the visible and the invisible. How to bridge the chasm? What means are there for transporting the unseen into the seen, or the seen into the unseen? There are three traditional bridges: mathematics, music, and myths. Mysticism might be considered a fourth. However, mysticism unites visible and invisible. All things are transparent and proclaim their invisible ground. So for the mystic, there is no chasm and no problem. Engineering a rational connection between the realms may only push them further apart. That is why mystics recommend contemplating a dilemma rather than trying to fix it. The equations of math, the notations on a musical score, and the personifications of myth cross the limbo land between two worlds. They offer a seductive front that seems to present the unknown other side, a seduction that leads to the delusional conviction that math, music, and myths are the other side. We tend to believe that the real truth of the invisible world is mathematical and might be put into a single, unified field equation, and or that it is a musical harmony of the spheres, and or that it consists in mythical beings and powers with names and shapes who pull the strings that determine the visible. The three modes transpose the mystery of the invisible into visible procedures we can work with: higher math, musical notations, and mythical images. So enchanted are we by the mystery transposed into these systems that we mistake the systems for the mystery. Rather, they are indications pointing toward it. We forget the old lesson and mistake the finger that points at the moon for the moon itself. We believe Huldra's invisible back must be as beautiful as her front. What is the relation between what we see and what we don't? Is her back displayed in her front, and does the smile of beauty therefore lure because it is the best possible representation of the invisible? Beauty could be a bridge, but we can't be so sure. Huldra's back may be a horror. After all, the woodsman dies lost and frozen. So, though beauty has been defined by Neoplatonists as invisible presence, invisible form, and the divine enhancement of earthly things, it offers no structure and no permanence. Tracking its definitions through history will not lead us where we are now heading. Besides, beauty has been reduced to the other three bridges: mathematical proportion, harmony of parts, and the radiance of the goddess Aphrodite. Curious how the search for Huldra's back leads so deep into the mythical forest. And we can't get out by searching for familiar facts. The invisible shows no facts.
The stories that myths tell cannot be documented in histories. The gods and goddesses, and the heroes and their enemies are told about in stories inscribed in clay and carved in statues. But have they ever been physically seen? The fabulous places of myth are not in this world. All invented, just fables. The long-lasting and ever-renewing vitality of myths has nothing factual behind it. Nothing but invisibles lies behind all myths' strength. Myth is a mixture of truth and poetic fancy. This fading into uncertainty belongs to the very nature of myth, says the Plato scholar Paul Friedlander. Perhaps Huldra fading into the forest is myth personified, the basic truth of myth captured in a single poetic image. Usual life, too, is backed by invisibles. Those abstractions of high-energy physics that compose all the visible, palpable, and durable stuff we bump into. The invisibles of theology we kneel to. The invisible ideals that take us to war and death. The invisible diagnostic concepts that explain our marriages, our motives, and our madnesses. And what about time? Has anyone seen it recently? All these invisibles, which we take so for granted, seem much harder and firmer than the flimsy fantasies of myth. We live among a throng of invisibles that order us about. Family values, self-development, human relationships, personal happiness. And then another, more fierce set of mythical figures called control, success, cost-effectiveness, and the biggest and most pervasively invisible, the economy. Were we in old Florence or ancient Rome or Athens, our invisible dominance would have statues and altars, or at least painted images, as did the Florentine, Roman, Athenian invisibles called fortune, hope, friendship, grace, modesty, persuasion, fame, ugliness, forgetfulness. But our task here is not to restore all the invisibles, but to discriminate among them by attending to the one that once was called your daimon or genius, sometimes your soul or your fate, and now your acorn. Perhaps these other sorts of daily invisibles that we accept without thinking receive their hardness from our attachment to them. If we cling like barnacles to our favorite set of invisibles, then they must serve as rocks and feel as solid. Philosopher Henri Bergson explained why we prefer particles to myths. The human intellect feels at home among inanimate objects, more especially among solids, where our action finds its fulcrum and our industry its tools. Our concepts have been formed on the model of solids. Our logic is preeminently a logic of solids. Bergson concludes, therefore, that intellect is unsuited for actual living, and for the account of life. All the while, the same inadequate intellect fights furiously against other sorts of accounts, such as myth, which it condemns with solid arguments, buttressed with facts, supported by evidence, and structured by logic. William Wordsworth saw through the logic of solids, perceiving the invisible within them. To every natural form, rock, fruit, or flower, even the loose stones that cover the highway, I gave a moral life. I saw them feel, or linked them to some feeling. The great mass lay bedded in some quickening soul, and all that I beheld respired with inward meaning. Authentic tidings of invisible things, adds William James in his essay entitled On a Certain Blindness in Human Beings, where he quotes Wordsworth among passages from Ralph Waldo Emerson, W. H. Hudson, Josiah Royce, Robert Louis Stevenson, Leo Tolstoy, and Walt Whitman as witnesses to the presence of the invisible. James ironically praises and blames this certain blindness. On the one hand, he condemns our usual perception, which cannot see the invisible inwardness of rock, fruit, and flower. On the other hand, precisely this blinding of the usual intellectual mind and the blunting of its sharp edge permits us to say with Wordsworth, I saw them feel. The Wordsworth passage is a statement of mythical thinking and not merely a feeling.
I saw them feel shows a softer sensibility in intellect itself that can receive and understand the authentic tidings of invisible things. Just this sensibility in intellect, which I am also calling mythic sensibility, allows you to notice the quickening soul in which our lives are bedded. For Wordsworth and for mythic sensibility in general, the acorn is not embedded in me, like a pacemaker in my heart, but rather I am embedded in a mythical reality of which the acorn is but my particular and very small portion. What the Romantics called the quickening soul is today named psychic reality. It is all over the place, although we insist it is invisible. Intuition. The traditional mode of perceiving the invisible, and therefore of perceiving the acorn, is intuition. Intuition also includes what I have called mythic sensibility, for when a myth strikes us, it seems true and gives sudden insight. In psychology, intuition means direct and unmediated knowledge, immediate or innate apprehension of a complex group of data. Intuition is both thoughtless and also not a feeling state. It is a clear, quick, and full apprehension, the significant feature being the immediacy of the process. Intuitions occur to a person without any known process of cogitation or reflective thinking. Our perceptions of people are mostly intuitive. We take them in as a whole: accent, clothes, build, expression, complexion, voice, stance, gestures, the regional, social, and class cues. All delivers itself at once, as a full gestalt, to intuition. The old diagnosticians of internal medicine used intuition. So do photographers and astrologers and personnel managers and baseball scouts and deans of admission, and probably also CIA analysts, retrieving the field information and seeing in a mass of tedious data an invisible significance. Intuition perceives the image, the paradigma, a whole gestalt. Intuitions occur. We do not make them. They come to us as a sudden idea, a definite judgment, a grasped meaning. They come with an event as if brought by it or inherent in it. You say something and I get it, just like that. You show me a short, complicated poem and I see. We go to the blockbuster retrospective at the art museum and without reading the blurb sheet or plugging in the audio lecture, I suddenly find myself gasping, "Aha," in front of a painting on the wall. I've been struck. Your sentence that I intuitively grasp, the complex poem, and the picture on the museum wall are each expressive forms and quite visible. The rapid understanding that seizes me, bringing me to what psychology calls the aha Erlebnis, that gasping response of sudden insight, pulls or pushes my breath out of me by the force in the picture. Mythical thinking attributes this forcefulness which produces my insight to a power in the thing. The power in the thing establishes the reality, even the physicality, of the invisible. Another important characteristic of intuition is the way it works. It does not expand slowly as a gradual suffusion of mood, nor does it advance by thought, step by step, nor does it come to its insight by a careful examination of sensate details that compose the whole object before me. As I said, intuition is clear, quick, and full. Like a revelation, it comes all at once and fast. It is quite independent of time, just as myths are timeless, and fall apart when we ask of them temporal questions such as, when did this occur? What is the origin? Did the myth develop? Are there no new myths? Don't they result from historical events? And so on. The historian bound by the data of time never can quite get into mythical sensibility. Because intuitions are clear, quick, and full, and therefore so convincing, they can be wholly wrong, missing the mark just as quickly and completely as they can get it right. Jung, who placed intuition with thinking, feeling, and sensation among the four functions of consciousness, made a major point of intuition's need for its brother and sister functions.
Alone, it can pick the wrong horse as surely as the right one, or go off with paranoid certitude, oblivious of logic, feeling, and fact. But Jung's ironic realism regarding intuition was not shared by the idealist strain of intuitionist philosophers. Baruch Spinoza, Friedrich Schelling, Benedetto Croce, Henri Bergson, Edmund Husserl, and Alfred North Whitehead ennoble it one way or another as an axiomatic and quasi-divine gift that is, as well, a philosophical method of knowing truth. Intuition is also called upon for explaining creativity and genius, the inexplicable accounted for by a process that is itself inexplicable. But the idolization of intuition neglects especially its darkest shadow, the intuitive opportunism of the sociopath, and the clear, quick, and full seizures of the psychopathic criminal, whose unmediated and self-evident propositions produce wholly arbitrary and casual deeds of violence without logic, feeling, or appreciation of the real facts. Intuition may propose a way, but does not assure right action or even accurate perception. This we know from any of our immediate, self-evident moves, such as falling in love with the wrong person, making false accusations and issuing rash dismissals, and arriving at those sure self-diagnoses of medical conditions that prove wholly hypochondriacal. Though certain intuition may not be accurate, our mythic sensibility may pick up the authentic tidings of inward things, but authenticity can be assured only by checking the facts, looking back at tradition, thinking carefully, and valuing by feeling. For centuries, the Roman Catholic Church has used these methods for testing intuitive claims of sanctity and examining miracles. This excursus on intuition was necessary for three reasons. First, we needed an acceptable term for the kind of perception that sees mythically. I saw them feel. That sees through the visible, and that claims insight into the invisible. We needed to make psychologically plausible the idea of mythical sensibility, equivalent to that of math and music, so that reliance on myth in this book may carry conviction. To grasp or be grasped by myth, you need intuition. The relevance of a myth to life strikes like a revelation or a self-evident proposition, which cannot be demonstrated by logic or induced from factual evidence. The best evidence is anecdote, the telling example that lights up an obscure idea in a clear, intuitive flash. The second reason for this excursus was to show a common function at work in the three bridges, math, music, and myth, and also in the realm of aesthetics or beauty. It is intuition that gives them each their instantaneity and sureness. Kant's theory of aesthetics relies on intuition, as does Mozart's description of composition. Authorities who have examined poetic inspiration and mathematical invention show the immediate certitude of intuition in the examples they present, e.g., the mathematician Henri Poincaré's oft-cited statement that most striking at first is this appearance of sudden illumination. The third reason takes us again to biographies and to a terrible tension between intuition and tuition in many exemplars of the Acorn. Emerson wrote, "We denote this primary wisdom as intuition, whilst all later teachings are tuitions." Emerson opposes the two, seeing intuition as not tuition, insight and learning, the heart's imagination and classroom study, do not have to be opposed. Nevertheless, Emerson correctly intuited that strong division in many of the eminent who chose intuition over tuition. They quit school, they hated it, they wouldn't or couldn't learn. They were thrown out, their teachers walked out on them. Intuition at war with tuition. School days and nightmares. Cradles of Eminence, a delightful and well-documented report on the childhoods of 400 famous modern persons, states that 3/5 of the subjects had serious school problems. Rejection of the classroom is an international phenomenon and has little to do with whether the schools are public or private, secular or clerical, or with the philosophy of teaching employed in the various schools. Nor does the school difficulty of these eminent persons have anything to do with their family's attitudes, economic circumstances, or educational level. Hating school, failing school, expulsion from school afflicts all sorts, for better or for worse. Thomas Mann, who was awarded Nobel recognition largely for a novel he wrote in his early 20s, described school as stagnating and unsatisfactory. The great Indian scholar and poet Rabindranath Tagore, who, like Mann, came from an educated and well-to-do background, quit school at 13 because he suffered so much there. "I was fortunate enough to extricate myself before insensibility set in." Of his school days, Gandhi said that they were the most miserable years of his life, that he had no aptitude for lessons and rarely appreciated his teachers, and might have done better if he had never been to school. The Norwegian novelist Sigrid Undset declared, "I hated school so intensely, I avoided the discipline by an elaborate technique of being absent-minded during classes." The Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman called his early school an intellectual desert. The actor and director Kenneth Branagh so feared school when he was about 11 that he tried throwing himself downstairs to break a leg rather than go. Later, he withdrew into his room and read and read. The German filmmaker Rainer Werner Fassbinder simply could not remain in the company of normal children, and eventually was put in a Rudolf Steiner school. Jackson Pollock, who flouted school requirements as blithely as he ignored its dress code, was expelled from Los Angeles High School. John Lennon was expelled from kindergarten. The saddest story I have found of the miseries of the school child comes from the English poet Robert Browning. He was sent off to a boarding school at the age of 8 or 9. It so depressed him that he chose a leaden cistern in the school for his place of burial. It had on it a raised image of a face. He imagined this face as his epitaph, passing his hands over it again and again, and chanting, "In memory of unhappy Browning." As for the lessons, Browning said, they taught him nothing there. The imaginative, existentialist writer Paul Bowles did not get along with his new teacher, Miss Crane. He resented her authoritative style, and he adamantly refused to take part in class singing, and as a method of revenge, devised a system to do what to him were meaningless assignments without really doing them. He simply wrote everything perfectly, but backwards. For Bowles, the activity most detested was singing. For others, it would be Latin, or algebra, or sports, or English composition. The acorn draws the line, and no one can force it to cross into the territory of its incompetence. It is as if the oak cannot bend or pretend to be a lovely poplar. As the acorn brings gifts, it sets limits, and only if the school allows intuition into the tuitional methods of the teacher can a bridge be thrown across, allowing the gift to emerge from the limits. School failures are common. Is this because the child fails school, or because school fails the child? Either way, the gap widens between the innate intuitive ability of the child and the formalized tuition of school. As the writer William Saroyan put it, "I resented school, but I never resented learning." All the while he had trouble in school, he was reading on his own nearly every book in the Fresno, California Public Library. The composer, Edvard Grieg, said, "School developed in me nothing but what was evil and left the good untouched." Thomas Edison said, "I was always at the foot of the class." Stephen Crane, Eugene O'Neill, William Faulkner, and F. Scott Fitzgerald all failed courses in college. For Ellen Glasgow, author of On Barren Ground and a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, school was intolerable. Willa Cather, Pearl Buck, Isadora Duncan, and Susan B. Anthony also disliked school. Paul Cézanne was rejected by the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. Marcel Proust's teacher considered his compositions disorganized. And Émile Zola got a 0 in literature, also failing in German language and in rhetoric. Albert Einstein wrote of his middle school, which he attended from age 9 and a half,
I prefer to endure all sorts of punishments rather than to learn gabble by rote. Earlier, at primary school, he was not especially noticeable and was called Biedermeier, meaning a little dull, a little simple, a little unclever. His sister wrote that he wasn't even good at arithmetic in the sense of being quick and accurate, though he was reliable and persevering. Some of these characteristics were due to his slowness of speech. General George S. Patton was dyslexic and was kept back. Winston Churchill at Harrow refused to study mathematics, Greek, or Latin, and was placed in the lowest form, in what today would be termed the remedial reading class, where slow boys were taught English. His English, however, was not poor. His knowledge of Shakespeare was unusual and self-motivated. The gap between what is seen by the school and what is felt by the child can work in two ways. Mostly, the child following his or her invisible track is perceived as out of it, unteachable, obstinately difficult, even stupid. But pressure can build the other way as well. Diane Arbus, the quirky and extraordinary photographer, said, "The teachers always used to think I was smart, and it would torment me because I knew that I was really terribly dumb." Whether the child is perceived as dumb, like Einstein, or smart, like Arbus, the gap in perception between child and school remains unbridged. When perception of the invisible in the child does occur, as in the cases of Truman Capote, Elia Kazan, and James Baldwin, Chapter 5, it feels like an unforgettable miracle. Examinations especially can be a trial. The master bacteriologist, Paul Ehrlich, had to be excused from school compositions because of his complete ineptness. Giacomo Puccini consistently failed exams. Gertrude Stein would not take her final in a class at Harvard. Anton Chekhov refused to study classics and failed his school exam twice. These failures at school gave him nightmares. All his life, he was to be haunted by dreams of teachers trying to catch him out. Pablo Picasso, who could never remember the sequence of the alphabet, left school at 10, because he stubbornly refused to do anything but paint. Even his private tutor gave up on him, because Pablo could not learn arithmetic. Often it was not in school, but outside of it, in extracurricular activities, or during time spent altogether away from school, that calling appeared. It is as if the image in the heart, in so many cases, is hampered by the program of tuition and its time-bound regularity. Henri Matisse began to paint during a convalescence. H.G. Wells was slated for the retail trade. He broke his leg when he was 8, began to read, and was saved from commerce for literature. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and candidate for the presidency, Charles Evans Hughes, wandered the streets of New York City for 6 months while waiting to be accepted into college. William Randolph Hearst and the artist John Lafarge added to their learning by wasting time in Manhattan streets. At 15, Marie Curie had a whole year in the country free from school. Who can prescribe where the acorn learns best, or where the soul puts you to the test? Exams are a ritual moment. Anything can happen. They mark transitions from one state of being to another, the way a wedding does, or like giving birth for the first time. Examination panics, together with the strange ceremonies of food and fetishes the night before the final, further show the ritual background of the test. An exam tests more than your endurance, ability, and knowledge. It tests your calling. Does your daimon want the path you have chosen? Is your soul really in it? If doing well on the test may be a confirmation, a failed exam may be how the daimon lets us know we've been headed wrong. Omar Bradley, a 5-star general who held in mind vast campaigns involving millions of men and tons of supplies, was near the bottom on his test scores, in Group 27 of 28, when he entered West Point. Through plotting and grinding, he worked his way up to graduate 44th in a class of 168. In the same class, Dwight D. Eisenhower was 61st and James Van Fleet 92nd. Tuition helped Bradley's intuition. Intuition also helped him get into West Point when he had to sit through 4 days of 4-hour exams each day. "I had a terrible time with algebra. At the end of 2 hours,